Okay, so I was asked to talk a bit about the dirty tricks you play when you try to hatchimize a part home sample. And in fact, this is what we're going to include into our new event generator. Okay, the outline, I just skim over what cluster fragmentation really is, and I'll comment a little bit on our version. Okay. Let me start with a simple example. We have an, this is really simple. It just looks confusing, but it's simple. So we have an E plus E minus event producing quark anti-quark pair, which then radiates off some gluons and a photon. Now, at some scale, you stop the parton shower, and you find yourself with a number of color singlets which are spanned between quark and anti-quark pairs, for instance this one or this one, with a number of gluons in between, and you wonder what can you do. Now Torbjörn and the Lund programs usually take the Lund string, and Herwig does the cluster fragmentation, which is much simpler. That's why we took it, because it's so incredibly simple. So what you then do, or what you might want to do, is to bring your partons to, if you haven't done so far, to constituent masses, 300, 400, 500 MeV for the light quarks. And you have to bring the gluons to a mass which allows them to split into light quark anti-quark pairs. In Herwig, the gluon mass is implicitly in there. We decide, okay, well, we want to be independent of whatever we think we should do in the parton shower. So we apply some scaling within each singlet to make sure that all our partons are on the constituent mass. Then you force the gluons just by definition. Now it's time for you to split, and they split, and because we found it's a nice idea, we took the glue to quark anti-quark splitting function. You could have taken isotropic decay as well, but I mean, you have to make a choice, and this is somehow, it seems to be kind of motivated. And you already get the feeling that this is a number of choices you do. And in fact, hatchimization models is just about the choices you do. So one of the choices is to say, I want to, the gluons to be split into quark anti-quark pairs, and I tell them how to do this. What you then automatically have is that you have neighboring colors made of quark anti-quark pairs, which form color neutral clusters. And you're kind of done halfway. Yeah, that's this is one of the this is the principle. I now want to go to the dirty tricks. The singlet gluon, which splits here, it's the same as this one, and you now see it in full glory. You could think about saying, okay, yes, in the parton shower we go to large NC limit and we don't have color reconnections, and you might think of modeling these color reconnections at the very end. And in fact, this is an option we have. Naively, you would expect that this happens with a probability of 1/9, and in fact, this is not good enough, as I'll show you in a minute. And what we also do is we attach an additional weight depending on which cluster configuration gives rise to, for instance, smaller masses or smaller relative transverse momentum of the two partons. So I want to say this has nothing to do, nothing, with perturbation theory. You can imagine that these guys, when they finally split, are living in a strong color field, and miraculously, color is reshuffled. I just want to say this is not perturbative, right? It's just a definition, a choice you may want to make. And in fact, we played a little bit with it. And this is the cluster mass distribution for lab one events. So you see they reach up to roughly 90 GeV. And the blue line is the cluster mass distribution you would have without any of this dirty trick. The red line is what you would have without adding a kinematical weight. So this is just the 1/9 probability. And the green one is what happens if you add a kinematical weight. And in fact, this is good because it makes sure that one of the nasty features of cluster fragmentation, namely the occurrence of very heavy clusters, is reduced. So this is working for our favor, and therefore we think this is a good choice. It happens because Sudakov weights never are exactly one or zero. If you want to have a parton shower from 90 GeV to say 1 GeV, so there's some probability that you end up with a quark anti-quark pair having a 90 GeV mass, having not radiated off any gluon, and then you say, okay, and now I want you to decay softly. So this is obviously an option which is, well, not really nice, and this is...
At the 10 to the minus 7 level, are there isotropic events of the Z?
I don't know. No, I wouldn't say so.
It's the same question.
Right.
But it's kind of well known that if you kind of take the Hurwitz model and let all clusters decay isotropically irrespective of their mass, then the points sitting at 20, 30 GeV are enough to give you a mess.
Right. Right.
So you can't let those high mass events decay as
So altogether, we'll come to that in later on when I talk about how to decay the clusters. But in any case, I just want to give you some hint why this might be a good option.
You really get ignored at the Z bus.
At some point, you stop.
Because our radiated is once the radiated all is considerably above temperature by itself.
Well, we have.
We have a different shower.
So
I was just amazed it was that much lower.
Yeah, it's good for us, right? I should say I have no real idea what happens a few more bins out there. Maybe it's 10 to the minus 8, maybe 10 to the minus 10, and in fact, well, I just don't know. Now you're sitting there with a number of clusters and you think, well, what do you do now? And the basic idea is that you understand clusters as being something like super excited heavy hadrons, which we don't know, of course. So what you want them is you want them to decay, and you want to make sure that you, in a decay chain, you finally end up with some hadrons. So what you do is you let them decay, and to let them decay, you need to produce new flavor, which presumably is just light flavor because the color field between two quarks won't be strong enough. Now, in Herwig, the option is made to have to decide according to mass of the cluster whether the cluster is going to two new clusters or to two hadrons. We play it a little bit differently. So what we basically do is we say, okay, this cluster is going to decay anisotropically, and there's the first non-perturbative parameter, and we then pop out light quarks or diquarks out of the vacuum, this number here, and we have two more parameters coming into play, strangeness and baryon suppression, which then will tell us which type of flavors you pop out.
Sorry, does the cluster have a preferred axis along which it fragments, or is that axis?
Look, if you would take it isotropically in its rest stream, of course you have no axis. What we do is we take it anisotropic in the sense that if we have two momenta of the quarks in here, P1 and P4, we say that the total four momentum of a new compound is given by a combination, and we shuffle.
What I'm saying is, if you create the Z from some equation analysis, then there's no correlation between, and you make a very massive cluster.
Right.
There's no correlation between the axis on which that cluster decays and the original.
There is in the end. There's in the end. There has to be. What we also do, which I don't have on transparency, is if we have something that we call leading flavors, which is quarks that we had that we did produce perturbatively within the parton shower, we make sure that we keep the direction. So we keep track of these quarks, and we just shuffle the direction of the momentum according to Gaussian smearing. So in that respect, if this was a cluster sitting just on the set, the two new clusters would remember their direction.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah, I'm missing the point. So the things that didn't make it, and so they're basically the original quarks.
Right. Right, and I mean this holds true also if you have say second generation quarks, you can still go to the rest rim and the cluster would remember the original directions. Okay, and now we let them decay. So what we do basically is we calculate these momenta, and from this we calculate the mass of the compounds, and then we just decide whether the new compound is a hadron or a cluster according to which hadrons we have in our model. So the new compound will have a certain flavor content, and we can look it up in the list of our hadrons, which hadrons do have the same flavor content. We take the heaviest one and we just compare. Is this cluster or is this new compound heavier than the heaviest hadron or not? If yes, we'll have a cluster. If no, we'll have a hadron. In Herwig, this is done by definition of a threshold mass. We kind of have a moving interface between the region of clusters and the region of hadrons. And now if we have something like a decay going into a cluster and a hadron, of course the hadron up to some bright Wigner smearing sits on its mass shell, and then we just shuffle momenta back and forth. And a simple thing that might happen, that you produce very light clusters, you make them hadrons immediately and let the recoil be taken by the neighbors. So this is not too complicated. This is already what I said. Now, if we decide on which hadron to take, it will be a combined weight which is made up of phase space and some kind of flavor spin wave function. And one has to take a little bit care there. So now this is already what I want to say. I just want to show some results because at the moment it's still in the making and we only have the light quark sector in it. We just want to include the heavy quarks later on. So the first few results are our stuff tuned against Pythia 6.1 in comparison with Herwig 6.1. And so this is just made to show that we can fit other Monte Carlos if we tune our hadronization model with them, and that we do not spoil things that are, that we do not spoil multiplicities too much, or that we do not spoil things like the 1 minus thrust of charged particles too much. So our model produces the correct multiplicities and somehow the correct energy flow. Okay, same is true for the differential jet rate. Now, comparison with experiments. So we took the same tuning and we compared with the charged multiplicity in one of the two hemispheres and compared with OPAL data. So the OPAL data are in green with error bars. Doesn't look completely bad, so we were quite happy about it. And in fact, this was a plot I liked best. So I should say Pythia and Herwig were tuned to fit the OPAL data. And we tried really hard to make it look the same. And we didn't manage, and it was really, really frustrating. And then we came to the great idea to check for the SLD data. It's an accident, but it was really nice. It made my day, after all. And
that's out of the box here with Frank, or it's still...
Sorry?
Is that out of the box?
No, that's a tuned thing we got. What you can see, something that is inherent to all cluster models, if you check for momentum fractions taken, you see some kind of overshoot. And we have the same overshoot, a little bit milder, but it's here around 0.5, which is exactly the effect of the heavy clusters that we do not get rid of. So the heavy clusters are bad. We have a few less than Herwig, as Peter pointed out. That's why our plot looks a little bit friendlier. But this is an intrinsic weakness of cluster models. I don't think that one can do much more better. And well, another nice thing is scaling with energy. I should say it's still light quark sector only. This is charged multiplicity, and it seems we produce a good scaling for the multiplicities. So the very short conclusion, I think this is what we're going to get into our code. We'll have to work a little bit on it to include the heavy quarks, and there's a few options we want to explore a little bit more, but I think this is what we'll do. Thank you.